after 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. With me now is Emile D'Antonio, who is regarded as one of the most important and accomplished political filmmakers of the American left. In 1963, D'Antonio made his first and one of his best-known films, Point of Order, a denunciation of Senator Joe McCarthy. It was composed entirely of television file footage taken during the Army-McCarthy hearings and edited together without any external narration. This was also D'Antonio's first use of what he called his collage technique, an approach which was inspired by the ideas of composer John Cage. D'Antonio's 1966 film, Rush to Judgment, examined the controversy surrounding the Warren Commission report on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. In the Year of the Pig, released in 1969, was on the history of the Vietnam War and included film from the French military archives and network news outtakes which were previously barred from the public. In 1975, Emile D'Antonio, Mary Lampson, and cinematographer Haskell Wexler met for a few days in a safe house with members of the Weather Underground to produce a film which was released the following year as Underground. Before its release, the film and the filmmakers were subpoenaed by the FBI. They refused to cooperate, and many Hollywood celebrities, including Warren Beatty, Shirley MacLaine, Jack Nicholson, and Martin Sheen, publicly defended them. The subpoenas were withdrawn shortly before they were scheduled to appear before a grand jury. Emile D'Antonio is in Philadelphia today and tomorrow for a special appearance organized by the Neighborhood Film Project at the International House, located on 37th and Chestnut Streets in West Philadelphia. Tonight at 7:30, D'Antonio will introduce two of his films. The first is Milhouse, a white comedy featuring former President Richard Milhouse Nixon. D'Antonio says of this film, "I didn't make this film to elect Democrats. I made it to reveal the terrible comic theater that is American politics." Also tonight, in The King of Prussia, a recreation of the trial of the Plowshares 8, the group of peace activists, including Phil and Dan Berrigan, who broke into the King of Prussia General Electric plant, which manufactures nuclear missile nose cones. They hammered on the nose cones and poured blood on different papers in the plant. Then they chanted while they waited to be arrested. All 8 of the defendants were convicted in a trial which was recently overturned. Last month, a new trial was ordered by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which concluded that the original trial and the procedures of the judge violated the rights of the defendants. The film, In the King of Prussia, was shot during that trial and featured the original defendants playing themselves, with Martin Sheen playing the role of the judge. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock at International House, D'Antonio will present his 1972 film, Painter's Painting, on the group of artists which developed in New York following World War II, including Jackson Pollock, Robert Motherwell, William de Kooning, Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Frank Stella, and Andy Warhol. A new book will soon be released, based on the interviews included in the film, titled Painter's Painting, A Candid History of the Modern Art Scene, from 1940 through 1970. The number for more information about the film screenings tonight and tomorrow is 387-5125. Also, Emile D'Antonio will present a 3-hour seminar tomorrow afternoon beginning at 2:30 at International House. The number again for more information is 387-5125. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. That was a lot to say, and there's a lot more to say about you, but that's the highlights, I hope.
I'm glad to be here, Danny.
One thing I thought we could start off by asking is you've called yourself, you're a Marxist, and you make reference to that in previous interviews. What's the significance of seeing yourself as a Marxist? Could you define that for us?
Well, if we had 3 years, I might come close to a definition. It's hard to define the word Marxism today because I think there are so many splinters of it. And the space I occupy as a Marxist is a very tiny space. I'm not particularly supportive of the Soviet Union, say, and that brand, that particular form of Marxism. But the basic assumptions of Marx are, I think, what generally they would cover the positions I have about the nature of society. I'm a materialist. I believe that economic functions determine most of the other social functions. I believe that what Marx called the primitive accumulation of capital is the way that those who have means and skills dominate those who don't have means and skills. I think that this leads inevitably, as Marx believed, to a kind of imperial structure of which we at this point are the leading example. And in the 19th century, Germany and Britain and France would have been the leading examples. And I think that the only way, finally, that power changes is the same way that the people of this country took power and gained freedom from the British, which is probably in some kind of struggle that involves violence. I would like not to believe in violence. Since making the film In the King of Prussia, I've struggled very hard to become a pacifist and even to become a Christian. But I think the other beliefs are too deeply ingrained in me to change, or maybe I'm too old to change. But I probably respect the Christian pacifists I know, like the Berrigans, more than I do any Marxists I know. But that still doesn't prevent me from feeling that I am a Marxist rather than a Christian or a pacifist.
How do you think your politics affect your aesthetic sense and your filmmaking?
Well, they can help but affect most of the work I do. I mean, they're serious politics. I really believe in them. And I made most of my films for political reasons. I even made the film Painter's Painting in a curious way on the negative side for political reasons. I've felt that most Marxists, including the people of the Soviet Union, had the most primitive ideas of art. I mean, art now in the most generic sense, to include film, writing, and also in the very specific sense of painting. I mean, painting is a kind of unique phenomenon in that it, from the Renaissance on, it was always a sponsored art. I mean, bishops sponsored it, cardinals sponsored it, princes sponsored it, British royalty. And it's not unusual, say, that the American corporations and people with money and the museums, which are controlled by those people, should sponsor painting. But they don't make paintings and they don't make painters. Frank Stella said this to me once in a conversation better than anybody. He said, painting isn't made by money. He said, you make a good painting and money will follow it and chase it. But there, first of all, first there has to be a good painting. I mean, the people with money can't make paintings. They can buy them.
Let me ask you a little bit about Painter's Painting. From what I've read, I understand that John Cage really helped introduce you to a lot of the people involved. What was his influence on you?
I lived in the country when I was young, and Cage was a neighbor of mine. Cage was at that point very poor, and he used to come to my house every night, and we would drink together. And he and my wife and I would have arguments about politics and about Aristotle versus Zen Buddhism, John being a Zen Buddhist. And he helped to create an aesthetic sense in me. I mean, I always had a sense of painting. My father was an intellectual. I mean, I was thinking about painters like Cimabue and Giotto and before I was 10 years old. But Cage made me understand more than any other single person what it was to be a modern person, to be a modern living in, that was actually in the 50s, but to be living in 1950-something and now in 1984. I mean, the painting I loved was all done by dead people until I met Cage. It was characteristically, so many political people are conservative in art. I mean, they're very radical in politics, and the paintings they like are Daumier and, you know, the more political pictures of Goya. But they don't like much of what's alive. And it was a whole turnaround for me. I suddenly saw that the work being done in New York, in some cases by people I already knew, because I always liked painting, and was really just as important, it was more important than the work that was being done in Europe. And in fact, after World War II, it was a time in which New York painting, not American painting, just New York painting, became just as Florence was the great city of the Italian Renaissance, or Paris ruled painting for 100 years. New York became the center of world art. The Germans, the French, the new Italians are all imitating us. And you could feel that there was a revolution in the art of painting. And John got me into that. He was the one who introduced me. The first two really first-class painters I knew were Rauschenberg and Johns, and John introduced me to them. And after that, I met a great many. I mean, I already knew de Kooning. I'd met Pollock. I met some of the older people, but I wasn't able to relate to them as quickly as I related to Rauschenberg and Johns.
Do you think this group of artists had to go through a long period of trying to define what they were doing, because they were becoming the center of the art world and they hadn't yet really developed what they were doing yet?
Well, the older ones did. You see, I mean, one of the things that happened was that when World War II happened and when the French capitulated to the Nazi armies, French culture was cut off from the rest of the world. There was no place for the French to develop. In fact, so many French artists, because they were regarded by Hitler as being decadent, came to this country. So suddenly people like, this is before I was anywhere on the art scene, but people like Jackson Pollock and de Kooning, who was European anyway, came from Holland, but also one of my favorite people, Barnett Newman, and Gottlieb and Rothko, et cetera, were all meeting these surrealists. And Peggy Guggenheim opened a gallery in New York in 1944 called Art of This Century, which was essentially the work of Europeans and some Americans. So the Europeans brought something here that was necessary. I mean, modern American painting comes out of Europe, but it is uniquely American. The two things that it comes out of are Cubism, going all the way back to wherever you want to begin, the early days of Braque and Picasso, and also, I would say, Surrealism, which we would, you know, say from the 30s on. Those two ideas, though, were totally changed. I mean, they were ancestors of United States painting, not... When Pollock suddenly discovered the unconscious, and he was in Jungian analysis, when Pollock suddenly discovered the meaning of the unconscious and knew the surrealists and was involved with the problem of cubism, he developed a new kind of painting that was uniquely of the stuff of this country.
How do you think all of your friends in the New York painting world responded to the pressures, first of rejection, of having to find themselves and having to find an audience, then almost an immediate success?
Well, that happened in a different way to different generations. I mean, the older people, there's a sequence in my film that is very touching to me when Barney Newman says, I had my first show, and one-man show, and I was 44 years old. And de Kooning says, I had my first one-man show, and I was 45 years old. You know, those people went through a lot, including being on the WPA, including having no money at all, including not selling anything, or selling a picture for $10 that today is worth $1 million. They lived very close to the vest. Rauschenberg did, and so did Johns in the beginning. But after that, it all moved very quickly. I have my own theory of time. I realize that Gertrude Stein once said it, but I didn't know that until recently because I've always had this theory of time. Time, as it's treated by historians, is an abstraction. You know, time isn't carbon dating. Time has to do with social reality. America is the oldest country in the world. In 1905, we began mass production. We began the $5 a day under Henry Ford, unheard of in Europe. We're the oldest people. We also have the oldest factories. If you want to know how old we are, go to Germany and look at those new factories. Go to Italy even. And look at those new factories. And then look at all the factories between Philadelphia and New York over there in Jersey, falling apart, rusted factories. We're an old people in a real historical sense. So that the time of everything that we were involved in here is a kind of curious time. And de Kooning kicked doors and walls aside, and so did Pollock. But their time took a long time because things still... But our time is a time of speed. And each year it gets faster and faster and faster. More and more things happen that we can't even keep up with. So it took de Kooning and Klein and all those people a long time. Stella, I met Stella when he was a student at Princeton. 2 years later, he was in the Museum of Modern Art at the age of 22. I mean, unheard of, 23. Unheard of, you know? I mean... De Kooning wasn't in the Museum of Modern Art, neither was Pollock until they were in their late 40s. I mean, that's the distance, that's the time space, the time factor.
Let me reintroduce you for people just tuning in. My guest is Emil D'Antonio, who is going to be appearing tonight and tomorrow night at the International House as part of the Neighborhood Film Project program. The period he's talking about is documented in his film, Painter's Painting, which will be shown tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And for more information, you can call 387-5125. One of the reasons that you made that film, apparently, was because of an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one that you said would probably never, ever be duplicated again. Why not?
Well, in... 1969 and 70, a friend of mine, Henry Galtzeller, who was the curator of modern painting at the Metropolitan Museum, did a show for the centennial, for the 100th anniversary of the Met. And the name of the show was New York Painting, 1940 to 1970. The Met simply has a kind of clout that no other organization in the art world has. There are those huge galleries. Each one of the people in that show had, in a sense, a one-man show. But the other thing that really is curious and important is that modern painting is very fragile. American painters, the great New York painters, used industrial paint. The color is not even constant. Jasper Johns painted his first American flag on a bedsheet, not canvas. When Rembrandt painted, he painted on the stuff of eternity. And the same was true of Giotto, and the same was true of Da Vinci, and Piero della Francesca, and Cézanne, for that matter. So these paintings, and particularly the works of Rauschenberg, which have animals in them and all, and one of his paintings is a bed, for instance. One of his works is a bed. These all are fragile. The cost to insure a show like that, they're strewn all over the world. Because, see, the other thing about American painting, people claim we're cultural imperialists, is because it's a turnaround of history. In the 19th century, wealthy Americans went to Europe and bought all the best Impressionist pictures. You can see better Impressionist pictures in New York than you can in Paris. And now the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians are buying major American works. And these paintings that were in Henry's show are already all over the world. To bring that show back together would be a matter now of millions and millions of dollars in releases, in insurance, in freight, in mounting the thing, in having the best restorers in the world, in the insurance bills, et cetera. A show like that will never exist again. It exists in my film.
What were the challenges of filming at the Met?
Well, first of all, the Met didn't want any filming done. But because of Henry, who, as I say, was my friend, the camera crew and I were permitted to go in the museum after 8 o'clock at night when there was a shift of the guard. And here were all these guys, most of them were New York ex-cops, all with the big .38 on the hip, watching us. And they couldn't figure out why we were wasting all this money, because they knew how expensive film was. What were we doing filming a painting by Barnett Newman, which is essentially a black space with a thin red line going down the middle, you know? I mean, they felt that they could do that. And I got on their good side right away because I guess I'm like a New York cop, too. I mean, I knew they liked beer and New York-type sandwiches, so I had a young man who was the assistant camera person go out and buy a lot of beer and pastrami and ham and cheese sandwiches. So they stood around the museum eating these sandwiches and drinking beer and watching us film. They got to be fairly friendly. In the beginning, they said, "What the hell are you doing in this room? Why are you filming this this Frank Stella? Look at these striped pictures. You know, if you go 15 galleries down there, you can film Rembrandt." And I said, no, Rembrandt, you know, we're interested in New York. Frank Stella lives in New York. He's, at this point, in 1970, he's 47 years old. So, you know, he's a young man to be in a major show, probably the youngest painter ever to be in a show of that kind. And that's what interests me, I said to them, you know, that they're of my time, my city, my place. And they were very sympathetic. I mean, we filmed... I mean, this is a kind of joke, you know, but there were those big paintings, and modern pictures, old pictures are framed in gold and all that kind of stuff, and all that old stuff is neutral. But pictures that are framed today in shiny stainless steel, anybody who knows anything about cameras and know what I'm talking about, knows that that when you start to light them, that the stainless steel causes hot spots, which means that suddenly the camera really wants to film the frame instead of the... So... The guards didn't care. I took gaffer tape, you know, that tape that we use in film, put it along the sides of the frames to dull that so we could get proper lighting. I had a great camera person, Ed Emschwiller, who's a very good and an extraordinary crew. Film is a social art, and it's never any good unless all the people in it are fairly good. Mary Lamson is an extraordinary filmmaker herself now.
You shot that film in both 35mm color for the art sequences when you're in the museum, and then with the interviews with the artist, you used a grainier 16mm black and white. So why did you use both stocks?
Well, that's basically who I am. I mean, I knew the painting should be filmed in 35 under the best on the best stock, and that they that would make them as true as possible on the screen. They're never really perfect. Even a perfect still photograph isn't as good as looking at the picture, obviously. On the other hand, I see people in black and white, and that's not a historic prejudice. It's just I see people in black and white. So when I went to the studios of all these people who were friends of mine, I shot them in black and white 16 millimeter. I like that whole idea of the camera being light, of the camera on M. Schuller's shoulder, walking around with it as the painter and I talked. And then I had my idea of how these painters should be filmed. I think that you can see this scene. If you don't mind, I'll describe one short scene. I always saw Andy Warhol, whom I knew before he ever painted a picture. I knew him when he was just a commercial artist. A woman I used to live with gave him his first job, and she introduced me to him. And I always saw Andy as living in a sea of glass, a sea of mirrors, in which mirrors were constant. So when I went to his studio, I knew, of course, his place very well, that there were two large mirrors at either side of the studio, floor to ceiling. So I got cleared everything out of this long room. It was almost a half a city block. And then put a park bench in the middle. And I had M. Schuller stand behind us to film us and film into the mirror. So what you get, I always like people to understand have an idea of process in film. So on the long shots, you see the camera person, M. Schuller, filming into the mirror, filming Andy and me, and you see Mary sitting there with a tape recorder taking the sound. But when there's a tight shot, it's harder to understand because Andy is still looking into the camera, and it looks as if the camera is on the other side of him. The camera is still behind him, and it's still a mirror shot, but M. Schuller's control is so good that it looks as if we're an ordinary close-up, you know, shot from in front. Everybody was done that way. One of my favorite sequences in the film is Jasper Johns. And his studio was in a big bank. He bought a bank in a ghetto area. He got it for nothing. I mean, who could use a bank in a ghetto, you know? First of all, there was the problem of sound, the reverberations. I mean, think of being in a big bank. I'd go boom, and you could hear it. So, and just as we were ready to film, Mary said, "Hey, Dee, the radio's going full blast." I said, "I know the radio's going full blast. I hate most films, you know, and people sit there and watch them, and they're so accustomed to perfect sync sound that it washes over them. There's no demand made in an audience." I said to her, "Listen, keep the Beatles, it was. Keep the Beatles singing as loud as they are, because I want people to strain to hear Johns, because Johns is one of the few intellectual painters. Johns is so incredibly articulate. I want people to work to hear it. I don't want it to be easy like most of those flaccid, buttery Hollywood flicks."
My guest is Emil D'Antonio, who is in town this weekend to speak at the International House as part of the Neighborhood Film Project. Tonight at 7:30, they'll be showing two films, Millhouse and In the King of Prussia, and then tomorrow night, a screening at 8 o'clock of Painter's Painting. And the number of the International House is 387-5125. In Painter's Painting, the artist Barney Newman, who you said a few minutes ago, got his first show at the age of 45, was it?
40, yeah.
He, in describing critics, he said this. He said, "Aesthetics must be, for me, as a painter, what ornithology is for the birds." And I was wondering what you felt about that quote and if you felt that way about criticism and theory yourself.
Well, there's a difference between criticism and between critics and theory. I believe that about most critics. I mean, critics, every artist in the world, whether he's in film or helps to create huge industries. When you think of all the people who live off of one relatively unknown filmmaker like me, there are all sorts of critics who write. There are all sorts of people who put on my work. And I need them too, of course. But basically, the artist is where it begins. In the case of somebody like Barney Newman, I mean, I knew exactly what he meant, and that's why it's in the film. Barney Newman was an amazing man. He taught philosophy. He ran for mayor of New York in the 30s on the Trotsky Party. He was brilliant. He was a whole bunch of contradictions. He weighed too much. He ate too much. He drank too much. He wore a monocle. He had emphysema, and he smoked 3 packs a day. And he was a great painter. And there was something that I've said in the book, Painter's Painting, that's not in the film, because in the book I write about what I felt about a lot of this, and that is that camera crews are funny people, you know, because they're hard and tough and professional. They do a lot of shooting. The camera crew that worked with me really loved Barney. There were other people in the film the camera crew didn't care about, but everybody loved Barney. I mean, Barney was an older guy, and he didn't try to be nice or anything, but everybody sensed just something really beautiful about him, which was there. And, you know, the only sad thing about the film is that Barney, and I'm glad, of course, I'm really glad that I filmed him more than anybody else in the film because he died a month after I shot him. And I'm glad that he's in that film because it's a good film, and he's there forever. And so is that work. And, well, there is no forever in our culture, of course, but he's there for a long time.
How would Frank Stella react to the criticism that his works, especially his black series, where the canvas would be mostly black with a series of parallel white lines, that work was unemotional and intellectual? How would he react to that?
The work was intellectual. And I don't think emotion is the primary concern of most artists in any field. What you really talk about, the word that most artists use in any field, including athletes, is energy. Frank always talks about, God, you can see the energy in that canvas. And you hear the same thing about a writer. You know, you can feel the energy in what he does, and it's the energy in a football player. It doesn't mean the strength, the size, or the speed. There's something else. That's the mystical element. What you're looking for is a new form of energy on that canvas. Everybody thought Frank's work was intellectually perceived and brilliantly perceived, and he could never do anything else. That was it. He was going to score with that first show. And Frank has proceeded from that first show to absolutely overturn the world by changing and changing and changing. And this year, he's finishing something next week that has probably taken as much courage as any painter's had, which is he accepted the Charles Eliot Norton Lectureship at Harvard, which has been held by Stravinsky and T.S. Eliot, and basically by people who are literary. The only painter who ever held it before Frank was Ben Shahn, who was not a very good painter, but who was a very literate man. And Frank is the most thorough person I've ever known. He's taken off the last year to make a study of Caravaggio and Titian and Tiepolo and Rainey. And in the course of that, he has prepared an absolutely brilliant series of lectures. There is no other American painter, U.S. painter, who is as conversant with the whole history of painting, who is as conversant with the history of ideas. And it's cost him a lot of money because the modern New York painter who is successful makes at least $1 million a year, and the lectureship is a $70,000 a year deal. So I think a lot of people are jealous of painters because they make so much money. They make as much money as movie actors.
I'd like to ask you about that. How do you reconcile that, your own political background and, on the other hand, the exclusivity and expense of art?
Well, there are two things. There's the painter and his art, and then there, B, the collectors. And those are two separate entities. They are, in a sense, necessary, but the painters, even the richest ones, live very simply. I mean, they may buy expensive studios and the best brushes and have four or five assistants and all of that, but that's necessary to the work. There's no doubt that this has been the keenest, maddest, most exciting art market. Jackson Pollock's very famous painting, Blue Poles, was bought by a dentist in 1952 for $8,000. Ben Heller, a kind of collector, hustler, dealer, bought it for $25,000 4 years later. In the 70s, it was sold to the Australian government, for $2.1 million. And, you know, in that period of time, to go from $8,000, Jasper John's painting, Target with Casts, it's a target, archery target with plaster casts above it, was in his first show, and it was sold for $2,000. The present owner of it has turned down an offer of $2.5 million. So the painter doesn't make that money. Jasper Johns got half of $2,000. The dealer takes half. So Jasper Johns got $1,000 for that painting. The present owner can get $2.5 million. So the big profits, particularly of the early works, which tend always to be the most valuable, they're always sold for a song. I hate to confess this as a Marxist, that I helped Stella. I've always had a little bit of money, so I gave Stella $500 to pay the rent in 1959 or 60. He insisted I take a black picture. I did. And I sold it before I should have, but I sold it. I sold it for $175,000 from $500. It was sold 2 years after I sold it for $425 at auction. And now it's worth $1 million. So you could say I could have made $1 million, but I don't look at it that way. A, I love the picture. B, I made enough profit. What, from $500 to $175? How can you be? I mean, it would be sheer greediness and insanity.
You had another Stella painting that I'm not sure if that was a gift or not, but it was one of his black paintings.
That's the one.
Is that the one that you had some friends come over and?
Oh no, I'm sorry.
Can you tell me tell us that story?
Sure. I had a small one that was a gift, and I used to live in a. I had some neighbors in that building who were. One was a very, very prominent psychoanalyst, a member of the New York Analytic Society, and all the rest. And her husband was a singer, and they were cultivated people. They owned Motherwells and all that kind of thing, and they were wealthy. It was a beautiful snowy day in New York, the kind I love. My apartment was near Central Park. I had the windows up, and there were big, soft snowflakes falling, and I had them in. And the psychiatrist said to me, "Dee, you're joking. What is that thing on the wall?" And she actually had a bottle of ether that she'd brought back from the festival in Brazil, and she just sprayed the ether on it. And the rest of the story is too unbelievable. The window was open, and this young woman I knew was out in the street, and I waved to her, and I was angry, you know. If there had been a man, I would have hit her. But I saw this woman. I waved. I said, "Come on in, Anne." And Anne was the Secretary General at that time of the American Federation of Arts, and she laughed at the picture and saw what the analyst had done, and she threw her drink on it. So two people attacked that Stella. This is before anybody had a Stella. So I told Frank, and he laughed. He said, "Well, people will do that." He said, I was much angrier than he was. He said, "I'll paint you another one." So I had two. I had a damaged Stella, and then, but see, people say anybody can paint a black painting with stripes, but he himself couldn't repeat it exactly, you know. I mean, the quality of the paint was different. It aged differently. And 10 years after it, the one was much grayer and the other was darker.
Let me ask you about Andy Warhol, because you said earlier that you helped him get his start. What did you do?
Well, one of the events that's described not only in my own book but in his book about the 60s, I mean, his story is, and it's correct, he lived near me, and I used to walk over to his house. He had this weird big house that he lived in, and he was very rich. He made a lot of money from commercial art. He drew all the shoe ads for Bergdorf Goodman, Vogue magazine, Glamour magazine, I. Miller, the main shoe companies. He was very, very successful. He used to knock out 20, 30 ads a week, thousands and thousands of dollars a week. So he wanted to become a painter, and he knew that I knew all the painters. So one day he put up these two Coke bottles, each one about 6 feet high. One was just a pure Coke bottle, black and white. The other was a black and white Coke bottle that had all these action, sort of abstract expressionist hatch marks up around, up and down the side of it. And he said, "Which one of these do you like, Dean?" I said, "Come on, Annie, there's no comparison. The one over there, that's just a plain Coke bottle." That's probably the beginning of pop art. He said, "Yeah, that's the one I like." I said, "Well, I'd destroy the other one if I were you. You know, you don't want any record of that. Because the first one's beautiful. You know, it's something brand new. Nobody's ever done anything like that." And I think that's really the way pop began.
He made a film. I don't know very much about it. It's called Drink. Is that something that will ever get shown or not shown?
No, my lawyer threatened him. I mean, Andy used to see me a lot and in restaurants. And he always used to say, "Dee, why don't we make a film together?" And I'd say, "No, Andy, you know, I make political films and you make your kind of films and we're friends and let's drop it." But one night I was sort of drunk. I was in Elaine's restaurant and I said, "Andy, I'll make a film with you." He said, "When?" I said, "Thursday." I said, "I'll drink a quart of scotch in 20 minutes. I said, "You know what that means." He said, "What does that mean, Dee?" I said, "Marine Corps sergeants, 22 years old, die doing it, you know, and I'm not 22, but I'll take a shot at it, and you film it, and if you're lucky, I'll die, and if I'm lucky, I won't." He said, "Oh, Dee, that's wonderful, absolutely wonderful." So I went to his studio. He gave me a kind of scotch I don't like, J&B. And I used to, before I had some more knee operations, I used to all sit cross-legged like Buddha. I sat cross-legged with this bottle of whiskey, and he filmed me, and I drank it all, and I threw it down the stairwell and broke it. And, that was pretty much it, except I was so drunk I couldn't get up. I mean, you know, it's a traumatic experience. It's not a joke. It's nothing I'd ever do again. But I'm a gambler, and I mean, I knew what the odds were, but I also knew that I was very strong and that I could hold a tremendous amount of liquor. So that
I'm not asking for this from this specific experience, but more generally, for you and your colleagues. Do you think it's productive to mix alcohol and art?
I think it's not productive, but I think it's sometimes necessary. I think art is essentially a kind of lonely, strange form of work. And I think this is the reason a lot of artists in different times, including ours, have used alcohol, drugs, all kinds of nutty experiences. When things go well, they're so high and so great, you don't need too much. But when things don't go well, it's a very lonely piece of work. And it also goes by generations. The abstract expressionists were all drunks. They all went to the Cedar Bar, Dillon's. They were also physical and macho. So many of the painters after that are gay, for instance. But the abstract expressionists were strictly into being butch, macho, drunks, fighting. And they needed that. They needed it because they had no audience. You know, nobody bought those pictures. They were alone. They were an alienated, isolated United States, New York experience. They knew they were good. Barney Newman knew how good he was, and nobody would even take his pictures. And the same was true of Pollock and de Kooning. They were all heavy drinkers. I mean, Pollock died because he was drunk when he crashed his car. De Kooning has survived because he's strong and he only drinks part of the time. Then he goes on long binges of being without alcohol. Others I know took heavy trips with drugs. The people who came after, not the...
Let me reintroduce you and also let people know that the film Painter's Painting, which is a document of all the artists that Emil D'Antonio has been discussing, that will be shown tomorrow night at International House as part of the Neighborhood Film Project, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And there's also going to be a seminar tomorrow afternoon beginning at 2:30 as part of Emil D'Antonio's trip to Philadelphia. The number for the Neighborhood Film Project is 387-5125. Now, tonight, there'll be a screening of In the King of Prussia and of Milhouse. Can you tell us what your goals were with Milhouse, what you set out to do?
Yeah, something that had never been done before. I like doing things that have never been done before. And in this case, it was to make a biography of a ruling president and a negative biography, a biography in the media. You know, it's the life of a man in the media. And it begins in 1946 when he was elected to Congress and goes through the 1960s up to the invasion of Cambodia in 1970. And Nixon was a very good subject because he was so awkward, so stiff, so ungainly, and he worked so hard at being pseudo-intellectual and being a communicator. And I've said many times that the real history of America is the TV outtake. I found all these extraordinary outtakes of Nixon. For instance, he did a commercial on blacks to get the black vote in the 68 campaign. And as soon as he's off camera, he says, I guess that'll take care of that one, right? And he didn't know that he was still on camera, you know, so of course I use that. It was true. It's real. It's not an unfair emphasis. I mean, it happened. And it was an amazing film because you cannot believe what happened. I mean, no one could believe it. I mean, I think that Linda Blackaby at International House has these, the Neighborhood Film Project has some of these documents. But here were the top people in the White House. I got all these from Senator Weicker at the time of Watergate. My film camp was before Watergate, of course. But there were memoranda from John Dean to Haldeman and Haldeman to Timmons and Dean. What are we going to do? Subject, the White House, Washington, D.C., subject, Emil D'Antonio, Milhouse film. What are we going to do about this? And they said crazy things. I mean, they were crazy people. They said, let us release derogatory FBI dossier on D'Antonio to friendly media. And he had all those wild ideas. Let's do IRS audits. I was already being audited by IRS. I mean, there was nothing they could do to me. And the film was very successful, but it was one of the few documentary films that made the variety charts and, you know, played in two big art houses in one at the same time in New York. But you always lose because, I mean, the business establishment that owns movie houses, unlike the art world, which is a much smaller world, the painting world, the movie world has really to do with large units. Milhouse was booked into a 70-theater chain in the West, and in one fell swoop, all 70 bookings were canceled. That was probably $250,000 to me out the window. But the manager of one of those theaters 2 years later sent me a letter and said, this is on my conscience. I've got to tell you why we canceled. He said, we had a call from Washington demanding that Nixon be given equal time. And, you know, that was so crazy, so utterly nutty, because there Nixon was. He was on the tube and in front of the American people. Every time he opened his mouth, it was on the front page of the New York Times or it was on CBS News. And here I was, an obscure left-wing filmmaker. The equal time was it was simply an excuse to destroy the—it didn't destroy the picture. The picture did very well abroad. It still plays all the time. It makes money. I mean, I can't complain. It's the only picture in which Ronald Reagan dies, by the way, because I have the Gipper scene from the Newt Rockne story. See, Nixon had no original ideas of any kind. He took all his rhetoric, and there's one sequence that I really love in the film, in which he says, we've got to win this one for Ike. And I thought, where did I hear that line before? We've got to win them. I said, I know, we've got to win this one for the Gipper. So I got that piece of film from the Newt Rockne story in which Ronald Reagan plays the Gipper. So there's a cut to Reagan lying there dying, the fever chart rising. You know, early Hollywood graphics, the fever rising higher and higher. And Pat O'Brien, as Newt Rockne, says, you know, the George Gipp told me before he died, he said, Rock, if you ever need to use my name, and, you know. So they're playing the army and they're behind. And Pat O'Brien says, let's go out and win this one for the Gipper. And the Notre Dame team goes out and wins. And, you know, that, and Nixon's mind was like that, in sort of silly sports metaphors.
Well, the other film showing tonight is In the King of Prussia, and I'd like to spend a few minutes asking you about that.
Well, that's special for Philadelphia people. There's one man in Philadelphia I'd like to meet. He's a member of the Supreme Court of the Superior Court of Pennsylvania, and his name is Spaeth. He wrote a brilliant concurring decision reversing the decision, convicting and sentencing the Plowshares 8, which was done under Judge Salas in Norristown. The Superior Court overturned the whole thing. On the whole, it was an excellent decision. The most important thing, though, about the decision was that it upheld the defense of justification, which in the peace movement is the most important single idea there is. In other words, if this building were on fire, I would be justified in smashing the windows to get you out, say, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you explain how that relates to the case of the Plowshares 8?
Yeah. Their feeling is the same thing, that they had the right to walk into a GE plant and to destroy thermonuclear nose cones because there was something in the world that was much worse than a fire in a TV station, and that was the nuclear arms race, which would destroy the whole world. And so they were a lot promised by Judge Salas that they would be allowed to use the defense of justification. And yet, when he made the charge to the jury, and it's in the film, he said, justification has not been shown in this case. It is not a proper defense. It cannot be used. So the jury, which might it was split enough to have had a hung jury and no conviction, the jury was a decent American jury. It followed the judge's rules, the judge's instructions, and the judge repeated this to them. So justification is a primary idea. One is justified in breaking the law to preserve a higher order of being, which is life itself.
What were your original intentions of the film that you wanted to make, and what evolved?
With the Plowshares 8?
Yeah, in The King of Prussia.
Well, in The King of Prussia, the original thought, I was never as keen for that as the press pretended, but the original intention was to shoot the trial. And that was a temptation to every documentary filmmaker because it was, you know, all this stuff goes back a couple of years. A few years back, the Supreme Court made a rather remarkable decision which was that trials could be filmed, and this would be entirely discretionary within the states. Now, what has happened so far has been disgusting. I mean, the films that people have chosen, the trials that films that people have chosen to film have been rape cases, violence, murder, almost no political cases. Nobody wants to film political cases because the state doesn't want them filmed. So I applied to Judge Salas, and I had as a lawyer one of the distinguished, most distinguished jurists in Norristown, Morris Gerber, a former judge of that court and a former president of the Bar Association. When we walked in there to present the petition to Judge Salas, we were searched as if we were criminals. Everybody went in out of that court was searched, including Dan Berrigan, who was a priest, including nuns. Everybody was searched as if nuns were going in there carrying 38 automatics. So Salas refused. Through Gerber, I was able to put the case before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania within a few days, and the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania upheld Salas. So I had to make my own. So I wrote my own script out of the trial transcripts and did a reenactment, did a fictional version.
What did you choose to focus on in the original transcripts? Because you had to pare it down.
Well, curiously enough, one of the main ideas I chose was justification, because to me that was the heart of the trial, and the Superior Court of Pennsylvania seems to agree with that. But I tried to strip it down to the chief legal arguments and to describe the action and why these people were motivated and to give them a fair trial in the film, which they did not receive in court. For example, Salas promised them that they could have expert witnesses, very famous people, you know, Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers, Falk, professor of international law at Princeton, Lifton, professor of psychiatry at Yale, a specialist in the damage of nuclear war from a psychological basis. And the most important guy of all, Bob Aldridge, who designed about five generations of nuclear weapons and is now a peace activist. Salas said all these people can testify because there was a defense of justification. When they got there, they came from all over the United States. Salas said, you can't testify. So I took them outside the courthouse and filmed them, and then I put them in the film. The film is all my films. There's always more there than meets the eye. I mean, there's a mixture of reality and of invented material. The reality material is those people standing in front of the courthouse.
How'd you get Martin Sheen involved in the film?
Well, he's a friend of mine from before when I had trouble with the government when I made the film at the Weather Underground. He was, as you mentioned earlier in the program, he was one of the people who... And I met him, and we became friends. And he's also a very, very sincere Catholic. And Dan Berrigan was a hero of his. So he offered to play any part I wanted, and he offered to put money into the film. And he and I are still friends.
Do you think that, do you have any ideas as to why American films seem to, by and large, be so apolitical, especially in commercial media?
Well, I think most large commercial enterprises in the arts are non-political in this country because the people who own the enterprises that produce these films are themselves the ruling, one of the ruling segments of this country. They don't want political films because the way I see you use the word politics, perhaps the way I do, politics to me would be films that are critical of the establishment. They don't want that because they are the establishment. I mean, Warner Communications, Paramount Pictures, I mean, those people aren't exactly your around-the-corner guy owning a mom-and-pop theater. I mean, those are hundreds of million, in some cases, billion-dollar corporations.
A friend of mine has a theory that I wanted to mention to you, and this occurred to her, I think, after The Day After was on television, and there was an interview with a screenwriter who apparently did have a point of view opposing nuclear war, and this shocked people that this screenwriter wasn't
sure.
Objective. And the theory is that in America, films are frequently regarded as part of the journalist media, which is supposed to have some type of objectivity, not have a point of view behind them.
Well, the very concept of objectivity doesn't exist, you know. I mean, the concept exists, but it's totally fallacious. Nobody except... a jelly bean can be objective. I mean, I can't be objective about what happens in the world. I can't be objective. I could not make a film about glass blowing in Czechoslovakia, where they do very good glass blowing. In my mind, would go, what was the 68 revolution about? How was the Czech freedom movement suppressed? How is this reflected in the glass industry? How does that affect conditions, et cetera, et cetera? But I don't think that that's – I don't think objectivity is a thing in this country. I think that we substitute entertainment for seriousness or politics or art. I don't think that alcohol, neither alcohol – I hate to say this on your air, but I don't think either alcohol or drugs is as dangerous to the minds of the American people and the future of the American people as television. There's been no more successful brainwashing tool. We are the most brainwashed people in the world. The Soviets aren't as efficient at it as we are. When you think that you get up in the morning, you turn on that tube at 6 o'clock in the morning and it runs for 23 hours, 23 hours on three main channels, not to mention cable and all the other channels, you can absolutely – I think it destroys public memory. It destroys patriotism. It destroys the idea of history. And it supports the police, which is what bothers me. There's so many cop shows in which cops are always great guys. You know, they never pull a gun unless they have to. It's exactly the opposite of the way the world is. And if a whole people is inculcated with lies, how can they make real choices in an electoral process?
Can I ask you about some of the commercial movies that have been shown? I don't know if you've seen them.
I don't go to many movies, so let's try.
What are ones that have impressed you positively or negatively, and for what reason?
You'd have to go way back. Chaplin. Mm-hmm. Chaplin. There are just a few people in film who really wanted to be artists. I mean, Chaplin is a great artist, a major artist. He's with Picasso. I mean, he changed the way people looked at things. He had such an effect on sensibility, on the form of film. You have to worry about the form of film, about what is being said. And Chaplin, okay, there are a few people. Griffith, a right-wing person. He's much more important than any of the left-wing people who made out in Hollywood. I mean, the saddest thing to me was that the Hollywood 10, who were communists and who unjustly went to jail, but as filmmakers, most of them were just as bad as the guys who were making regular right-wing films. They had no concern for the form of film. They just had sort of good left-wing politics. Their idea, you know, they're also sad because during World War II, their idea of real left-wing politics, they did a film about an American ship going to Murmansk, and the cast is on the deck, and they say, "My God, there's an airplane." And he says, "That's okay. It's one of ours, and it's a Soviet airplane." That's their idea of propaganda. It's ridiculous. It's not even dangerous. It's just ridiculous. Chaplin's a different thing. If you look at The Immigrant, you really know as much about what it must have been like in a 10-minute film to be an immigrant and the unnecessary authority and brutality of the law in relationship to that one specific immigrant who becomes all of us who are immigrants. There are so many of his films that touch upon the entire human condition. I think the same thing was true of Keaton. I think that all these people are left-wing, whether they mean to be or not. I mean, to me, the Marx Brothers were fantastic because they were so – I guess I'm an anarchist. They were so free-swinging and hostile to large established order. I mean, notice that Groucho plays the prime minister of a country, the president of a university, a doctor who is really a horse doctor and giving pills that big. I mean, these are all the things we hold sacred and dear. The president of a university has got to be a straight guy. You know, in fact, he's chasing girls around the camp, women. I mean, in those days they said girls, so we can't say anything else. I mean, you know, it's and they're very funny. They're brilliant.
I know you're not a big fan of like the Star Wars films.
No, Star Wars is a fascist film. And all your listeners who are serious about film know that beautifully shot end of Star Wars comes right out of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. When Luke Skywalker walks down that long sort of alley, followed by his two friends to receive the decoration, that's exactly the same shot that was set up by Riefenstahl with Hitler at Nuremberg walking down with just behind him Hess and Himmler. The glorification of killing in that way, that pseudo-mystical idea of the force, the laughing, pretending to have equality with all those strange misshapen figures, you know, this is like we really have racial equality, including these objects. I mean, everything is turned around, and And it's all trickery, you know. It's not art. It's trickery. It's brilliant trickery.
How about Woody Allen? Do you watch his films?
No.
Do you have any upcoming projects that, that you're
reviewing? Well, I'm doing another book on the art world, and I'm doing something that I've been putting up and lifting up and putting down, lifting up and putting down for 8 years, almost 8 years, 7 years, which is the story of my life as told by the FBI to be made into a film. And I have about 5,000 pages of documents from of FBI files about me. And, you know, the only crime I've ever committed was make films. I mean, I've never been a spy. I've never held up a bank. I've never even written bad checks. I mean, nothing that glamorous. I just make movies. And yet I have all these thousands of pages. And they've written my life story and in their funny language, which is not English. And it's FBIE's. And I'd like to do that. It's very, very hard. I mean, Sheen has told me he would play me, which is something that makes me happy, to get a young, handsome guy for an older person who isn't so handsome. But I was about that age when a lot of these things happened. So.
Well, I hope to see it. That would be truly an interesting film.
It's hard to make genuinely independent films, you know. The money isn't out there on trees. I'm a pretty good hustler. You have to. If you're an independent filmmaker, you know, students ask me all these questions that have nothing to do with film. If you're independent, you've got to be a hustler. You've got to find the means of production. You've got to raise the money somewhere. And then one hopes that one has some talent and sensibility.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon. It's been really interesting speaking with you.
To me, too.
And if you'd like to see some of the films we've been discussing, tonight at 7:30, you can see Milhouse and In the King of Prussia. And tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, Painter's Painting, and this all takes place at the International House as part of the Neighborhood Film Project. There's also an afternoon seminar with Emil D'Antonio tomorrow afternoon at 2:30. The number that you can call for more information is 387-5125. Thanks again for being here today.
Thank you very much.